Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers. And
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it
Michael Hohmeyer back with us with the It's the Law segment of Dresser After Dark. Michael, how are you?
I'm terrific, Michael Ray. Great to be with you.
Oh, absolutely. By the way, we've missed you. I would ask you what's going on in the world, but that would take about a month and a half to talk about.
Boy, all I do is leave town for a couple of weeks and look what happens.
Look what it, you see, if you hadn't left, none of this would have occurred.
Right.
You know, I had somebody on the show yesterday, as a matter of fact, yesterday, and he was doing some predicting about what's going to happen because of historically, you know, we run into cycles and history repeats itself, et cetera. And what he said, which was kind of interesting, he did say that he said he thinks Israel will be Israel will be going to war with Syria and a couple of those countries around there. We'll go through an economic hard time for a very short period of time, and then we're going to get back to where we were, and things will start looking good again.
Well, from his mouth to God's ear, let's hope that if there is a conflict, that everything ends as well as that.
Yeah. No, I hear you loud and clear. But coming back, being gone for the couple of weeks and coming back, what was the first thing that hit you? What did you have to sit back and say, I don't believe this is going on?
Oh, well, coming back to the desk in the office and seeing that our clients are continuing to struggle in this economy, they can't raise money, they can't start new businesses, they can't grow their businesses, and worst of all, they can't hire the people they need to launch or expand their businesses. Of course, it would have been a miracle that anything could have changed in 2 weeks, but one always holds out hope. Hopefully that change will come next year, but boy, it continues to be so desperately needed. There are so many businesses we work with who feel themselves hamstrung in their ability to hire, or I should say their inability to hire, their inability to get financing. They can't get investment financing. They can't get bank financing. They can't get small business loan financing. It really hurts small businesses, and we see that with the small and medium-sized business clients that we have in our practice. That's a huge, sad reality, and it's shocking in a way that it's been ongoing. How old is this recession now? Coming up on 3 years? It's
shocking. By the way, Michael, we were told that we're not in the recession anymore, so you have to believe what you hear, right? I think the concern really is this. The money's there. The money is there. And when I would go all the way back to when I first I was exposed to Obama the first time, and I thought, this is a brilliant man. This man is so smart. He's doing everything he can possibly do to work on his ideology, and there was going to be fundamental changes, and he was going to do what he was going to do. And I thought, quote, unquote, plot and plan behind it. I'm a pragmatist more than more than anybody who looks at underneath it and what's going to go on from here and who's doing that to who and et cetera. So that said, as I watched him do what he's done, the decisions that he's made, the playing around that he's done, and I'll give you this, the guy's over his head. He got into something he just doesn't know how to handle, and there's where the problem is.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I think that is as powerful a truth about this man as it is that he does have a particular agenda that he wants very much to fulfill. And I don't believe that it's been demonstrated to be a conventional American exceptionalism-based vision of this country. I think it's something very different. So I think both of those things are true at the same time. Number one, that he has a very different version than about America and what future America should have than do a majority of Americans. And number two, he, thank goodness, is not more confident about pursuing his vision, or he might have been able to do more damage than the significant damage I see he's already done, not just to the country generally, but also when I look at my own clients and trying to make business work in California.
Yeah, now here was the problem also. You know, General Electric, lost a great amount of money. You know, they got money from the they got some of the stimulus money. Now they're opening plants in China. There's work being done there. There was one of these green organizations, you know, the conversion for power, et cetera, that they got stimulus money. They went out of business. They're opening up in China. And I really believe that he dumped so much money into so many things that he thought would make the change, quote unquote, more government takeover. Those things just aren't working. And the people he gave dollars to weren't surviving through that. So there was something missing within the strength of those people that received the money, also the decision to give that money. Billions of dollars going to all kinds of all kinds of programs all over the world, and nothing happening here. We've got trouble on our streets. We've got separation between races. We've got, I mean, this list goes on and on and on. You know, we want Sharia law in some of the state governments because we don't want to be insensitive towards someone else. My goodness, all these things that are going on right now, it's diluting who we are, and there's going to be a backlash of this, and it's going to come to fruition because people are starting to stand up and talk. Even the African-American community is starting to sit back and say, what's going on here? We're not getting the promises we were made.
And that community should feel that way because that's absolutely right. If anything, many minority communities have suffered even more than the mainstream or the entire country has suffered. And that's been a promise that's been woefully unfulfilled. If anyone could benefit from a rejuvenated expansion and the return to the economic dynamism that we've enjoyed for 25 years before this recession got made even worse by this new administration, those communities might well, and I believe would, benefit because even more than the entire nation would have, because the opportunity for growth percentage-wise is much greater when you're starting with folks who may have had to deal with disadvantage or discrimination in the past. And there's a lot of serious interest in bringing people who hadn't been participants in the economic miracle that was this country and will be again this country's story after 2012, I predict. Those folks who hadn't been able to participate or should have been brought in, could be brought in, will be brought in, assuming that there is a change, but they have not been brought in the last 3 years. This administration has been worse for them than it has for the general community, or the entire community, if you will, just them. It's been worse for these communities, these minority communities, and that's really the most tragic thing about what's been going on or not going on the last 3 years.
Sure. Let me give you a prime example of what I think is going on. The Dream Act, effectively. Now, we wanted to close that down. We wanted to stop that. You know, there's got to be this point whereby we've got to stop the illegal immigration. The people that are illegally in this country do not belong here. So the president usurps the Congress's power, overrides them, and allows people to stay here. Now, one of the things that happens is it gives us a tremendous financial burden, no question about it. And the other thing that it does is this. It gives him, quote unquote, in his mind, the backup of those people. They're going to get votes for him. They're going to stand behind him because of what he's doing. While he's ruining the country on this end, he's trying to get votes on the other end. And at the same time, he's going to take the African-American community, who has a problem right now with the Latino, the Spanish community, because they're taking jobs away. There's going to be some blood on the streets, Michael. I'm telling you right now. And that's not conspiracy.
Yes, that's absolutely right. And the way to avoid that is to have there be a return to economic sanity, a return to economic expansionism, a growth economy that we used to have before this recession, which I believe was significantly caused by the policies of the Democrat Party when they took over the Congress in 2006. And obviously there are other aspects as far as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the housing debacle and the whole nine yards as far as that's concerned. But remember, this whole mess began before this administration took office, but not before his party took power. And they made a bad situation far worse than it should have been. And who that has penalized the most are the folks that you're absolutely talking about. When we get back to a rejuvenation and a return to the fundamentals of our founding documents and our founding philosophy, there will be a return to a growth economy that will put that will generate opportunities that will put people to work, and that will help to diffuse the tension that is being created and then stoked by the policies of this administration and its friends in Congress. So, you know, the way to tamper down the fires of ill will is to provide economic opportunity. That can be achieved if we return to the tried and true mechanisms of our past, our up to our very recent past, that will put people to work. That will be the way to diffuse these tensions, not by pitting one group against another.
Now, by the way, Mitt Romney said corporations are people, and I happen to totally, completely, 1,000% agree with him. It is the corporations who spend the money to do the expansion, to create the jobs that will fill that void that we have right now. Yes, there's some bad apples, yes. Michael. There's no question about that. You know, everybody is a bad apple, though, in a corporation. So it's the corporations that basically got us there. The other side of that is there's trillions of gallons of untapped natural resources that we have in this country that could turn everything around, that could create jobs, that could drop the price of oil. There's so many things that we could deal with that they won't allow to happen.
Absolutely right. But what it does mean is that if we bring about the change that we think is needed, and it is, if we bring it about, almost assuredly, if those kinds of policies are followed, we will bring back the growth economy. We will revive American entrepreneurism, American exceptionalism, and justifiably so. These opportunities are just out there for us to grasp. They're almost low-hanging fruit. And it may well be not only that the fruit, if you will, of a change in administration next year is not just changing the politicians, but also reflecting that there's been a change in the mindset of a sufficient number of Americans to say, we want to go back to basics, we want to go back to what we know worked, and that means sane, commonsensical environmental policies, commonsensical policies as far as growth, commonsensical policies dealing with unions, not outlawing, but not giving them all the power either. Balance, common sense, a return to these kinds of attitudes and philosophies will almost certainly result in a revival of the growth economy that will put America back to work. And there will be such an explosion of growth if we do this. There's so much American money that is sitting on the sidelines and not being invested in small business or medium-sized businesses, who, by the way, happen to be the businesses we work with as clients, as attorneys. Those are our clients. Those are the economic engines, the employment engines that put most people to work. They will put most people back to work if they can only get the funding that they need and deserve, and that a change in policy.
No, and by the way, are you still there? I heard this cut out. Somehow we lost him. All right, let me keep going until we can get him back. Well, and one of the things that we really have to take a look at is not necessarily the economy, not necessarily those, the quote-unquote, which falls under the economy, the jobs that we do or don't have. What we have to look at is the way politics are run today. It's gotten to be not a right or wrong. It's gotten to be who's going to win. And the problem with the who's going to win, the first thing that we have is if somebody decides to run office, we're going to find out everything about them. We're going to drag out as much dirt as we can possibly drag out and say not how good they are, but how rotten they are. And it's going on both sides, Republican and Democrat. Ron Paul recently, they started an entire campaign to find out any women who have ever kissed Rick Perry. And we know where that's going to go if they find some kind of a problem in his past. I think between Romney and Perry, one of the two of them, I like the idea that if one of the two of them gets in, they are business-oriented. They are people who have done things. They're people who have made money in business. And they've compensated. Michael, you back?
I am, sir. Yes.
Good. Okay. Somehow we lost you. I was just talking about the problems with running for office today. One of the things that happens politically is the minute you say you throw your hat in the ring and you get trashed. And Ron Paul recently, both sides, Republican and Democrat, the big campaign to find out if any women who've ever kissed Rick Perry to talk to them about it. Now, they're looking to destroy the guy. And effectively, this is the kind of political, I'm going to call it garbage, that we have to put up with. You don't get to the real issues. I'd like to see a Rick Perry, I'd like to see a Mitt Romney kind of person in that White House who has a business background, who has been there, who has done that, who understands the ebb and flow of cash and understand cash in, cash out, and at the end of the month, what is or isn't left over.
Well, see, those two issues that you're speaking about are both critically important, and they coexist, and they need to be addressed at the same time. And if they are addressed, they will result in the economic recovery and a return to the growth economy that will put America back to work. Number one, we've got real problems in this country. We need to work hard to turn this economic distress around and return to financial stability. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to be quick and easy. It's going to take work, but we need to start in 2012. Arguably, we started last year with the midterm elections. But we need to focus on fixing the problems. We don't need to focus on somebody's background and digging up phony dirt. People have important issues that they want addressed. They want employment. They want security, national security as well as personal security. They don't appreciate the fact that politicians and the mainstream media are wasting people's time on these idiotic issues and trying to find dirt on Republicans. People don't want to hear that. They say, let's get not only the attention on dealing with our problems, but let's make a change and put the country back to work and get back to our fundamentals that have made this country such a mecca for success and prosperity and such a haven for entrepreneurial-minded folks from all over the world for 250 years.
You know, I would love also to see us become blind with color and gender. One of the reasons that I say that is that it's used as such a weapon to control people's speech, control what people say. You take somebody like, who was it recently? Her name's right on the tip of my tongue. Sheila Jackson Lee. Was she the one that said the Tea Party can go to hell? All right. What would happen? And she was addressing the Black Caucus. What would happen if somebody said that about the Black Caucus? All hell would break loose. And then I think the concern there, Michael, is this. That you've got to neutralize color. You know, if we got the right person in that White House, I don't care if they're green, I don't care if they're the whatever gender. The point is, you got somebody who's powerful that's going to do the job. There's got to come a time when this stuff has got to be stopped. It can't be used anymore. You get obviously not all, but you get some of the African American the representatives. And you hear, okay, they're trying to do it to us. They killed Martin Luther King. They did this. They, meaning white people. The problem is it starts the separation and people get hurt who shouldn't have to get hurt, who don't believe in any of this stuff. If you are a human being and you're decent, you come into my home, I'll feed you, and you can stay here. But if you're not, don't come through the door, and I don't care what color you are.
You know, one of the tragedies of this recession is that it is being used to hide the racial progress that had been made and has been made in this country up to this point, especially in the last 15 or 20 years, which is not the entirety, I'm sad to say, of the time that I've been practicing law. So I've been practicing law longer than that. But just within the time that I've been practicing, there has been a huge sea change in how people of different races deal with each other in the business world. I get to observe this because, as a business lawyer, I work with clients, and those clients are of every race, of every ethnicity. And I don't mean just that you've got a black business dealing with a white business or an Hispanic bank dealing with an Asian client, but I mean people of different races together on the same bench within a business. And like never before, I have seen harmony, people working together, and the racial divide has dissipated significantly within business. And this has been a real thing, not a make-believe, not a want-it-to-be-true, and it didn't come about because exclusively of government interference. It came about because people finally learned that the lines that divide are not as important as what binds, and that there are opportunities for people if they judge each other based on character rather than the color, as the great Martin Luther King had said, it's being accomplished. But this recession and the way that different groups have been pitted against each other for political gain has clouded that reality. It's hidden that reality. But I saw it as clear as day in watching clients that I was working with interacting with each other, interacting with other institutions and other business folks. There's been an awful lot of progress that has been hidden. But when there's a return to economic sanity and what I would call normalcy, when we get our fiscal house in order, and I'm assuming that we will, of course, and we return to a growth economy, and we return to first principles, and we return to, more of a, not the European-style demand economy model, but back to an American economic model, we will not only see the end of the recession, but we will also be able to tear away the clouds that are hiding the increasing economic growth that has led to increased racial harmony. It can't happen soon enough because there's real damage being done when people are pitting groups against each other. But I think the bigger story is that for most people, the middle class, including people of all races, are working together today more than they ever have in the past. And I can't wait for that to be able to be seen more clearly once this recession is corrected.
You know, Michael, that's really the silent majority. We're starting to run out of time now, but just as an aside, as just an interesting point, do you know what political bent Martin Luther King was?
I actually heard that toward the end he was of a Republican bent.
You bet he was. No, he was a Republican, which I think is interesting. Anyways, Michael Homar, you have a website we can find you at.
We sure do. It's www.homeierlaw.com, spelled HOMEIERLAW.com.
You know, and by the way, very quickly, you know, with his I Had a Dream speech, more people should be listening to that, listening to what was said and acting on it, not what they're doing now. And with that, see you next week.
All right, talk to you then.
Good night. Desert oasis, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Greg Crabtree with us. He's the author of Simple Numbers, Straight Talk, Big Profits. He's a speaker, he's an author, he's an entrepreneur, and a financial expert. And after spending 5 years in regional accounting and 3 years as vice president of operations controller for a local bank, he used his entrepreneurial skills to develop Crabtree, Roenberger, PC, and CPA firm. dedicated to helping entrepreneurs build the economic engine of their business. And in addition to serving as the firm's CEO, he leads the business consulting team, helping clients align their financial goals, listen to it, align their financial goals with their profit model and their core business values. Greg, hi, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
Oh, hey, thank you so much for being here. Greg, I think one of the biggest problems that we have today, we have a tremendous amount of entrepreneurs out there. And there's a reason for that, because they got downsized. They had some ideas. They went home on their computers. They started to make some money. And some of them made some really big money. Greg, I think one of the biggest problems that we have today is those that didn't make the big money yet really don't understand what a business model is, and they fall down. Having a great product and a great idea and enthusiasm is wonderful, but when it comes down to it, you got to have the basis to be successful.
Absolutely. Yeah, and we see, you know, working with small businesses, you know, my target client that we like to work with is start up to $5 million is when we want to start the engagement with them, and we've had clients grow as large as $100 million before they sold. You know, it's an interesting to watch that process. And what we realized is the first thing that they all kind of stumble over is this separation between you get paid a salary for what you do and a return on what you own. And you don't want to confuse those two things. And what we find is when you get small business data from people, unless you apply the filter of have they appropriately accounted for their market-based wage for the job that they have in the business, you're not getting a clear read on profitability. And so, you know, we had a client we started working with, and they proudly told us that, you know, they had a 25%, you know, pre-tax profit. And then once I accounted properly for the wages that they were consuming to live off of out of the business that they were just taking as a distribution, they actually only had a 3% profit. And it was the reason why they didn't understand this thing of, well, we're profitable, but I have no cash. Well, no, you really weren't profitable because you were lying to yourself with your numbers. And so we worked through this process of really kind of helping them understand, you know, get your data to where it doesn't lie to you first, and then understand that economic engine of your business. You know, too many businesses out there are in the change business. You know, they're just swapping dollars with somebody, and you know, you're not going to create wealth that way.
Sure, and I think another way to say that is if I'm in a business and I'm making $1 billion a year, but it costs me $1 billion and $1 to be in business, I'm not making any money, and I'm in trouble, and I'm everything you just talked about.
Well, you know, you kind of described Zappos, I think. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if you look at Tony Hsieh's book, I mean, you know, Zappos is a great example of a company that had $1 billion of revenue when they sold it to Amazon. But the numbers that I think from what I was told, there's like $400 million of returns out of that billion of revenue. So did they have $1 billion of revenue, or did they have $600 million? And then from that, were they really profitable? Now, that's taking an extreme, and they did it. They built a wonderful company that has a lot of great things to talk about, culture and all those kind of things. But, you know, I mean, it's an interesting, you know, what he did with that company, you know, is really, really, really tough to repeat, much like, you know, you couldn't repeat creating Apple today, you know, but you can create something else. But the base rank and file guy that I work with, I got to make them understand that you got to be profitable first, and then the cash flow lags of that. And entrepreneurs, you know, constantly confuse cash flow with profitability.
Oh, sure. No question about it. And let's take it a step farther. I know one of the things you talk about is beginning to set the owner's salary. There's an interesting point. You know, you can set a decent salary, and I think the owner of the business, if that CEO has got the mind, if he's Steve Jobs, he should get paid big bucks because nobody else could get in there and do the job to create money, to create jobs for other people and have an impact on society in and of himself. But I think where a lot of the confusion gets is, okay, you got a salary, pick a number, you're making $250,000 a year, which is on the light side for a major CEO. Now, you're making $250 a year, but you're getting, you know, $400,000 or $500,000 in perks that we're not talking about, because the company's paying for you to go here, there, and everywhere. And all of a sudden, that $250,000, you're getting almost $1 million a year, which is a tremendous dent into that company. And we're not looking at, back to the word profitability, which is the net result of what comes in.
Well, you know, and it's not, you know, it's because of the size of the company, once you get over, you know, $10, $20 million revenue, that you know, the perks and those kind of things, you know, don't drive the bottom line near as much as it does in that start up to $5 million space. And what we've come to believe, you know, like I said, because of the area that we focus on, I've come to believe that, you know, once you're at $1 million of revenue, if you're not profitable and taking a market wage for the job you have in your business at $1 million, I'm going to question the validity of your business model. You know, and so, you know, from what we see, we've kind of coined this term that we believe the space between $1 million and $5 million is what we call the black hole of business. And, yeah. And that's the point that, you know, you can be the chief cook and bottle washer and the cash register attendant and the salesperson up to $1 million. But once you cross $1 million, you got to start building a team of people to work with you. And that's the very delicate stage that if you're undercapitalized, as most U.S. entrepreneurs are, you know, you've got to be very strategic and careful step by step to grow your way to $5 million without killing yourself.
You know, there's a, Greg, there's a comment that I probably make 3 times a week and a half for the last, you know, 150 years now. And it's always good to have somebody looking over your shoulder and seeing what you don't see. And that in and of itself in business is extremely important, because that very foundation that your decisions are made from, sometimes you're not seeing something in that foundation that could expand, you know, expand your income, expand your bottom line. So when you talk about what most entrepreneurs' numbers lie to them, most people look at numbers and they don't see what somebody else can see that is not involved and totally, you know, enmeshed in what the problems are of the business. And I really believe when numbers lie, it's not necessarily they're lying. You just don't recognize what a number truly stands for.
Well, unfortunately, I'm having to deal with some clients who are facing some challenging times at the moment, and they get into this mode of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, thinking that that's going to all of a sudden make them profitable. And realistically, you know, you got to go back and say, no. It's really, let's get focused on this business engine. And what we've kind of come to believe is a lot of people have, you know, just because a customer pays you a fixed amount of money, is that really revenue? And this is the point we've been driving home to a lot of folks. You know, revenue is for show, profits for dough. And so, you know, I want to make sure that, you know, if you're a business that's, you know, say you're a manufacturer's rep and you may do $40 million of revenue and you get a 10% commission off of that, well, do you really have $40 million of revenue? Do you really have $4 million of revenue? And that's a totally different business. And the best example that I use a lot is in construction. In my book, I show an example of how a $20 million construction company looks exactly like a $3,750,000 revenue service business. Because when you take $20 million of revenue for the contractor and you subtract out materials and subcontractors, which he's really just passing through the value of, and you come down to look at that gross profit number, that number is exactly the same as that $3.7 million service-based business. And from that point down, they look exactly the same, and you can actually compare two businesses that are in two totally separate industries and compare the viability of their business model.
Oh, sure, and I think the confusion, and stop me if I did, I'll say it in a different way than I'm hearing you, they're confused between the gross revenue and the net, what they stick in their pocket and walk away with at the end of the day.
Well, and the other thing I always am fond of saying, you know, most entrepreneurs, their accountant, either their internal or external, gives them the financial statements, and they never look at that thing called the balance sheet. And what we find in small business is all the dead bodies are on your balance sheet. And so, you know, your P&L is generally not worth the paper it's printed on unless you have all of the accounts adjusted on the balance sheet at the beginning of the period and the end of the period. And that's just simple, basic accounting 101. Unfortunately, they don't teach that too often, it seems like, in the business schools these days. But at the end of the day, you know, we try to teach the entrepreneurs and say, listen, guys, don't make this harder than what it is. And I really tried to be conversational in the book, you know, to really, you know, get entrepreneurs to say, hey, this isn't complex. And that's why we call it simple numbers. You know, if you're looking at too many, you're as blind as looking at nothing.
You know, I've learned a long time ago, Greg, and it's taken a lot of years to really get this. And academia, somebody can go to business school, they can learn all that they want, but what they're not going to learn is the wisdom to be able to handle it. And unless you're out there, OJT, on-the-job training, unless you're out there, there are a lot of things that you can't learn anywhere. So it's getting out there, falling down, then you listen to someone who's fallen down before so you don't have to make those mistakes. You can anticipate it ahead of time. It's almost like preventative medicine, which is, I think, so crucial for most people. Greg, do you have, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yeah, the website is seeingbeyondnumbers.com, and that's where people can find the book. The book's also available on Amazon and some of the bookstores around, but they can go there. And we're constantly trying to add tools that I refer to in the book, you know, for people to be able to look at some examples, and we'll continually to work on those things. But it really is that, you know, I want them to focus on the fact that don't be scared of the numbers, and really be honest with them for yourself and your own benefit. Because the key is profitability. Take that profit, manage the tax implications of it, and then use that after-tax profits to build wealth, you know, for your business and your family.
I hear you loud and clear. Hey, Greg Crabtree, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
All right. Thanks, Michael. Appreciate it.
Greg, good night.
You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. Higher education, how colleges are wasting our money and failing our kids, and what we can do about it. Our guest, co-author, Andrew Hacker, is with us. Andrew Hacker is the author of the best-selling book, Two Nations, Black and White, Separate, Hostile, Unequal, and writes regularly for the New York Review of Books and other publications, and he is a professor of Queens College. And let's say, Andrew, hi, welcome to the show. Andrew, can you hear me?
Oh, I can hear you perfectly.
Oh, good. Okay. I just did the intro. I said, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here tonight.
Well, higher
education. Andrew, do people really understand what education is? It's almost like a word that nobody can really grasp anymore.
I think you've certainly hit the nail on the head here. Our problem is that something called higher education, by which we mean college and eventually a bachelor's degree, is now costing at private colleges $40,000, $50,000, almost a quarter of a million for 4 years' worth of this. And the question is, what are you getting in return?
No, but I think another question is how does someone get there in the first place? You know, the average kid that wants to go to college, I know that there's grants and there's funding, et cetera, but not everybody can deal with it. And once they get it, there's something called payback, which I know they get into a lot of problems with. And I think education in and of itself today, well, let me ask you, you've been in the field for long enough that you went back 20, 25 years ago and you defined education. And tonight, Andrew, if you defined education again, would you find a difference in the meanings, and where did we get that disconnect?
Yes, I think there is a difference, Michael. Or do you prefer to be Michael or Michael Ray?
Whatever you're comfortable with, Michael Ray's fine.
Okay. I think the real difference, Michael Ray, is with, believe it or not, the professors, the faculty. When you say 20, 25 years ago, professors really cared about their students. They were number one on the professor's agenda. They cared about their classes. They paid attention to individual students. They, professors, make students their second or third priority. The professors are more interested in research, in consulting, in perhaps graduate students, and the young people who come to college looking for an education discover that the faculty isn't there. They're given adjuncts, teaching assistants, you know, part-timers.
Yeah, and did those part-timers, did they really know what they're doing? And those people who are there and had tenure, those people who were there, have they lost their faith in it? Have they lost interest? Is that one of the problems?
Well, as far as the part-timers, some of them are really quite good, but they're underpaid, overworked. They don't have offices. They're often in their cars driving off to another campus to make ends meet. It's not the way to, you know, get a college education. As far as the senior faculty are concerned, they have this thing we call tenure, which means they can stay on for the rest of their lives. And some of them are interested in teaching, but a very large number simply go on with what they call their research. And in fact, most of the research that's being done isn't really needed. You know, I think it's rather odd, Michael, right, to say, hey, is there knowledge we don't really need? But when you look at so much of what professors are spending their time doing, it's really just to bulk up their resumes.
Now, when we take a look at it today, let's add something to the mix. As you were talking, I was thinking about this. We are so high-tech anymore, you know, with the BlackBerries and the iPods, and the list goes on. I can't even name them all. And as we get into that, has that changed education? There was a time when you had to think. There was something called critical thinking. I wonder if that's starting to disappear within the ranks of education today, because if it's so technical, you don't need to critically think about it. Great example is walk into any market today, and if there's somebody under 20 years old and you pull out a $20 bill without that BlackBerry or the adding machine or their own calculator inside their computer, they can't count it back. And have we lost in that area?
I quite agree with you. But Claudia and I, who wrote this book together, we don't blame the students. That's too easy. We say the professor's job is to awaken, to arouse, to stir the interest of students. Take the technology that you're talking about. As you walk by college classrooms, increasingly, you see the shades are drawn, even in the middle of the day. The shades are all drawn. Do you know why they are?
No.
Not to keep the kids from looking out at the elms on the quadrangle. It's because the professors have put up something called PowerPoints. And they put flash onto the screen their successive slides, which are filled with 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, these bullets that they have.
Sure.
Now, how do you do critical thinking when you reduce everything to 3 or 4 or 5 points? I would thought that thinking regards a subtle interaction of various ideas, interpretations, but the technology has so turned it into points that it's hard to use your mind anymore.
And how do you apply those points, quote unquote, when you get out in that fashion, in that way? You know, when you get out of college, you have to start thinking on your feet. You get into a world where they didn't prepare you for that. It's not sitting in a room that's closed off, that the shades are drawn and the PowerPoints are going. It's in a world where you have to be responsible for the outcome of your actions. If somebody's going to put some money across the table and say, here, I've hired you, here's your pay, go do the job.
Absolutely. Hey, let's suppose your first job is that you're a manager, a night manager at Burger King. Yeah. One of the things you have to do is get the best performance out of a bunch of high school part-time kids who are coming in to do the burgers for you. Now, that takes
imagination. It takes ingenuity. It takes learning on the job. I quite agree with you.
No, by the way, I think where this really starts, I'm having these pictures going on in my head here. I think where this really starts, I'm going to go back to when I was in junior high school and high school. Andrew, in those days, we had auto shop, we had wood shop, we had metal shop, we had all of these things to prepare the kids that if you weren't going to go on with any ongoing and continuous education, at least you got prepared to go out and get a job after high school. Caused you to think, caused you to be responsible. If something went wrong, the project wasn't there. And I think that being taken away, because they do not do those things in school anymore, you take that away and you move somebody into the college scene, you haven't been prepared to critically think. This isn't just in college. This starts very early on in the educational system that we have today.
Okay. What I would add to that, Michael Ray, is that one of the purposes of college is not just to prepare you for a career, but to get you thinking and using your mind about the issues of philosophy, history, literature, the sciences. That
sure
can be done at college, and that is not preparing you for Burger King. Do we want our young people, in fact, all of our citizens, to be cultured, civilized, thoughtful, interesting people? Sure we do. And that's one of the purposes of college. And I think we should hold colleges to that standard.
Well, I don't want to get off on this, but I think a major problem that has held back that standard is political ideology, whatever side, political ideology that got infiltrated within the colleges, and I think a lot of the kids lost focus, and they forgot why they were there in the first place. You know, college, if you really come down to it, it's that extended education that you're not going to get out of high school. It is that basis for whatever endeavor that you're going to get into that needs some kind of an academic background to prepare you to be able to deal with what's there. I think the big problem we have today, and Andrew, I am not in a college today, but I think the big problem we have today is that they've lost their compass. Somehow they're off focus and they've got the wrong idea of why they're there.
I happen to agree with you. And I think the chief problem here is that too many professors, I'm not talking about their political ideology, I'm leaving that to one side, but too many professors are concerned with their own research projects. They feel that what they're doing research on is absolutely what students ought to know. That's absolutely wrong. What students ought to know are the great broad ideas, you know, of the world in which we live. And professors don't get status points by doing that. For example, in the sciences, we should have a broad survey introducing students to the theory of evolution, to biology, to genetics, you know, what science is doing. But you won't get professors who are willing to set up a course like that because they won't get promotions on the basis of that. You don't get promoted by establishing, setting up, working on a sophomore survey course.
No. And I think one of the things that's happened, I have your book in my hand, and Andrew, I'm going to go to the back cover, and I think that really says it all summed up in a sentence, that the two of you, you know, Claudia Dreyfus and yourself, show that the American way of higher education, a $420 billion per year business. Okay, that's the business. Oh, I see it right here, lost sight of its mission. But the point is, it's become a business. Now, obviously, they have got to bring money in to be able to continue on doing what they do. But I'm going to liken them to the pharmaceutical industry, who got off purpose years back, and now it's all about money. I'll liken that to politics, who they lost track. It became about money. So I think really what we have to do is steer this away from, quote unquote, making a profit to building those youngsters' minds. They're going to be the ones, Andrew, that are going to be running this country in years to come. Those are the people who are going to be responsible for everybody else.
Absolutely here. Now, it so happens colleges, at least on paper, don't make profits. But in order to cover their expenses, and the expenses run everything from sports teams to overseas centers and whatever, in order to cover their expenses, they simply raise the tuition. the tuition keeps going up. A lot of colleges are charging $40,000 and more right now. Now, what happens? The students are willing to pay, including taking out disastrous loans to do it. Why are they? Because they want a Bachelor of Arts degree. They want that BA tattooed on their forehead. Only the colleges can give them the BA. So the colleges keep raising their costs, their prices, and, hey, millions of people are paying. It's really not a very happy picture.
Well, the other side of that, too, is the kids that are here that were born in this country who go to college, who go, you go through the school system, are not getting what a lot of the kids that are coming in from foreign countries are getting. They're not getting the quote-unquote discounts. They're not getting their college paid for them. In essence, what's going on, that $42 billion, $420 billion, whatever that number was, that amount of money came right out of the taxpayers' pockets, but it also comes out of the tuitions that those kids who have to pay full price for, you shouldn't be paying full price based on, you know, if you level the playing field of everybody going to college right now. So there's some inequities there also.
Hey, the big thing, really, the chief source of colleges' cash flow are students taking out loans. Colleges may talk a lot about financial aid, but there's really very little of it. At best, it's a discount on the sticker price. And what financial aid officers do is steer the students to getting loans. Currently, student loans are approaching $1 trillion.
Wow.
They're more than the total credit card debt in the country. We're going to have something equivalent to the subprime mortgage crisis when more and more students start defaulting on these loans. And I don't blame the students. The only way they can get into a college is by taking out these loans. And by the way, it's not just at fancy private colleges. At the University of North Dakota, at the University of Maine, 75% of the students are taking out loans. Why? To pay for their expenses living away from home.
Yeah, I wonder how much of that, how much of those loans actually go into default, actually don't get paid back. I imagine there's a great percentage of that. That effectively, I'm going to go back to where did they get the money? Money comes out of the government. Where does that come from? Your pocket, my pocket.
You bet. Now, hey, back in 1905 and 1906, we thought all those subprime mortgages were going to get paid off. We're going to discover when it comes to 2014 and 15 that students with $100,000 loan debts are not earning the kind of money that can pay those back. And by the way, the banks so set up the loan system that you can't discharge them through bankruptcy. They can dock your Social Security payments even when you're retired. You know, this is going to be part of our lives in the next 10, 15, 50 years.
Oh, I know somebody. Go ahead.
No, and I'm saying the real culprit, though, are the colleges. A $40,000 tuition isn't necessary. You only have it because they have, oh, take a nice little college like Bowdoin up in Maine. Do you know what, Michael Ray? They have 37 intercollegiate sports teams. Hmm. When you pay tuition, you're paying for volleyball, water polo, alpine skiing. You know, this is ridiculous.
Oh, absolutely. Something else that I thought about as you were talking. I know somebody right now, I think 10, 15 years ago, she took out a student loan, maybe a little longer than that, right under $2,000. She defaulted on it. And to this day, she probably owes the government $17,000 or $18,000 on that less than $2,000 loan. So you got those kind of problems going on. The interest is absorbent on the payback on this stuff.
Absolutely. And now it's not 2,000 students are taking out. They're taking out 40, 50,000. And if they go to graduate school, like law school or business school, wow, they're going to have 200,000 in loans. You know, this is a cloud out there, and there's a downpour that's going to come from it.
Oh, boy. You know, we're starting to run out of time, but when you really come down to it, Andrew, it's all going to hit, and it's not going to hit over a period of time. It's all going to hit at once, and when it does, it is not going to be pretty. Andrew Hacker, let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure. The title of our book is Higher Education with a Big Question Mark, So for our website, it's higher education, and then you spell out the word question mark, and you'll get us then.
Wonderful. Hey, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, Michael Ray, this has been very enjoyable. You've asked all the right questions.
Good night.
And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold to you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark, Manufacturing Hysteria, A History of Scapegoating, Surveillance, and Secrecy in Modern America. Jay Feldman is our guest. He's the author. He's also the author of the critically acclaimed When the Mississippi Ran Backwards. He is a widely publicized freelance writer whose articles have appeared in the Smithsonian, Newsweek, Sports Illustrated, Gourmet, the New York Times, and many other national, regional, and local publications. He's written for television and the stage and is the author of the novel Suitcase Sefton and the American Dream. And his website is jfeldman.com. Hey, Jay, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Manufacturing, what was it about this particular subject, Jay, that caught your attention?
Well, actually, it started a little bit off this tack. I wrote a book proposal for a book on the Alien Enemy Control Program, which is part of the larger book that as it exists now. And the two editors at Pantheon, Dan Frank and Andrew Miller, liked my writing, wanted to work with me, and they suggested that we tell a larger story, use a broader canvas. So that's really how it happened. For your listeners, the Alien Enemy Control Program, everybody knows about the Japanese-American internment during World War II. But what's largely forgotten is that Italian and German aliens were also interned during World War II. And that's how my interest in it started, and it grew from there.
Now, when we talk about manufacturing, the problem started a long time ago, didn't it?
Yeah, sure it did. It started actually before in the run-up to America's entry into World War I. It's not that there wasn't prejudice against minorities before then, but what we, if you go back to the 19th century, especially the history of the reaction against Irish Catholics and Chinese. But what we see in the run-up to America's entry into World War I is a new phenomenon. We see the government creating this animosity, consciously kindling it, and using the fear and the hysteria that's then created through this scapegoating, in this case beginning with German Americans, sure, using that fear as a justification for a much larger crackdown on civil liberties and a suppression of dissent.
And this, well, by the pattern, way, Jay, we see that today. That's why I started out with manufacturing, and, you know, we create these things. Look at what's going on in government today. Forget Republican, Democrat, it doesn't matter. It's the same thing. They'll create something. They create the fear. The fear controls people, and if you can control people, you move them to where you want them.
Well, that's right. the pattern that I spoke of plays itself out time and time again from World War I forward in this country, and right now we're seeing it directed against Arab Americans and Muslim Americans, but also against Latino immigrants, and it, to some extent as well, homophobia is also rampant.
Okay, but let's take
now,
it from both sides. Just for a second. Let's take it from both sides. Absolutely, there's prejudices, no questioning that. There's also things that have been manufactured to create a particular movement. But at the same time, being in the media, I've been privy to some pictures and things that a lot of people don't get privy to. And I have seen some of the demonstrations from Latinos in Southern California that you wouldn't want the words repeated and the gestures and the whatever and about the anti-white and this and that. I mean, you know, it's a two-way street. And I think that's what needs really to be addressed. Yes, there has been things that have been created. But if it boils down to it, if we have the prejudice against, homosexuals, if it's against African-Americans, if it's against Latinos, and, I mean, the list goes on, that the underlying message says, Jay, it says the white guy is responsible for the whole thing.
Well, no, I don't think it does. Because the minorities that I'm speaking of can be racial or ethnic, it's true, but they can also be political, they can, yeah, be religious, and they can be sexual minorities. It's
sure,
largely forgotten also that during the Cold War and the McCarthy era, 5,000 homosexuals lost their jobs in the federal government because they were supposedly security risks.
Yeah. And it got you loud and clear, and there's no question about that. But it's always started because somebody has an agenda to fulfill, and somebody is going to be at the mercy of it and going to get hurt by it. And that, I think, has been a constant.
That's right. I would have to agree with that.
What do we do? Well, okay, well, what do we do? You know, when I say, Jay, what do we do? How do you stop this?
Yeah, that's a good question. The thing is, it's not that the United States is the only place where this happens. It happens all over the world. But as an American, I'm interested in the history here. And as Americans, we've been taught that we should hold ourselves to a higher standard. And so our history books generally give us a view of American history that's been pretty much sanitized, and it's a rose-colored glasses view of our history. The dark side of American history has generally been erased, although it's beginning to be filled in to some extent now. The thing is that if we're not aware of this part of our history, to use the old cliche, we're doomed to repeat it over and over again. But we don't have to do that. If we go back and take a look at how this pattern has manifested over the last nearly 100 years, we can ask ourselves, is this the right way to behave? I'll give you one example. During the Depression, between a half a million and a million Mexican aliens and Mexican Americans, many of whom were citizens, were deported or, quote, voluntarily repatriated, unquote, to Mexico. Now, many of these people had entered the country at a time when there was no border enforcement, so that crossing the border was not against the law. They lived in this country for decades, never became American citizens for one reason or another, but lived here and were productive members of our society. When the economy went belly up in the late 20s and early 30s, particularly it started in Los Angeles, there was a movement against Mexicans, they're taking our jobs. So many were scooped up in raids, sent back home. And the collateral damage from this was catastrophic for many of these families. So you would have a father who was being deported, and then the mother faced the horrible decision of, do I stay with him and go back, or do I stay with my children who are American citizens, have never seen Mexico, and have no desire to go there? Okay, so between a half a million and a million people were, for one, either deported or, quote, voluntarily repatriated. Now, that's an astonishing number of people, and it's astonishing that that has pretty much escaped notice, excuse me, in our textbooks. Sure. Okay, fast forward.
Let me hold you up. And by the way, with no question, there was some tragic things that happened that probably shouldn't have happened. But there's got to be that balancing, that homeostasis, that balance, that line in the sand. And we go back to the 30s and 40s. We don't see what we see today, what's coming across that border. You're dealing with drug trafficking, human trafficking. You're dealing with criminals that'll kill here and run back across the border. You've got all of those all of those things that come into the play that are added to the mix today that wasn't there in the 30s, or not to the degree that it is now. So what we truly need is a balance. We need some kind of a clearing process to really be able to look through this and distinguish between the two. Look at the gangs and the killing and everything that's going on in Los Angeles and some of the inner cities. I mean, you got kids out there in different ethnic groups with machine guns already. My goodness, I don't know what this is turning into, but that's got to stop. So you see a group of these kids doing this, and they say, don't profile. How do you not profile when you say a group of green people were doing this? You're going to go out and look for green people, not just everybody.
Well, right. I don't know any green people, though.
No, but I'm just saying it could have been Latino, African American. You hear what I'm saying?
Well, I do, but I'd like to pick up my point.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd like to pick up that point, but I'll address what you're saying here, too.
Sure.
In New York City, there's a database of people who have been stopped by the police for one reason or another. And, you know, they stop them, they frisk them, and they send them along their way. 90% of these people who've been stopped are totally innocent of any wrongdoing. And the database is in the hundreds of thousands of people, all right? 50% of these people who are stopped happen to be African-American, and another 30% are Latino.
Yeah.
All right. Whatever you want to say about that, those people, once they're stopped, they're in that database permanently. And when the chief of police was asked about that, he just said, well, we have no way to take them out of that database. Yeah, but why are innocent civilians who have committed no wrong, why is their information being collected in a police department database? It's simply because they're the wrong ethnic or racial minority. And my point about this is that after the 30s, when you fast forward to 1954, we see it again, the exact same thing. Was called Operation Wetback under the Eisenhower administration. Half a million people were deported to Mexico until there was such an outcry on both sides of the border that they stopped the program. All right. Now it's starting up. It's going on again. And so at that point, you just have to say to yourself, is that approach really work? It doesn't seem to work. There must be a different way, and I have to agree with you. There has to be some sort of balanced approach to it. And the Obama administration Justice Department happens to agree with us, too, because, as you know, they just the other day ruled that there are going to be 300,000 cases reviewed. So the people who get picked up and held for one reason or another simply because they fit a profile and actually have done nothing wrong and yet get held in detained anyway. During the First World War, there was a series of raids called the Slacker Raids. If you recall, the draft had just been enacted. And so these mobs of people would roam the streets. They'd stop young men at ballparks, on the street, in movie theaters, wherever, you know, in saloons. And they would demand to see their draft cards. Sometimes they would be accompanied by military officers and or police officers. So they'd demand to see. Now, so it was kind of a new phenomenon. Maybe not everybody was aware that they were supposed to be carrying their draft cards. So if you didn't have your draft card, it wasn't a second question. You were taken to jail, and you were held there until it could be proven that you were not a draft dodger. Well, the communications in those days were not what they were today, where you just punch in a number on the internet or a database and you find out. It required sending a letter or a telegram to the draft board, and it required the draft board meeting. So these people, many of them, could be held in custody for days, weeks, and even months until their innocence was established. Well, it turns around the very premise of our judicial system, which is innocent until proven guilty. This was guilty until proven innocent. And this same phenomenon has happened to Latinos today. It happened with Muslims and Arab Americans right after 9/11. A balanced approach, I agree. That's what it'd say. That would be much better.
But when it comes down to it, we're starting to run out of time, but when it comes down to it, Jay, how do you deal with it? You know, and we're a country that is supposed to be run or governed by a rule of law. Well, that doesn't seem to work anymore. It's more of a rule of man, and you do what you're going to do when you do it. And if you're in a geographic location in the country and you got a mindset and people think a certain way, that's how you handle things. You know, there are people who should not have been put in jail and have spent time. And there are people who should have been put in jail that didn't go to jail. So somewhere we've got a problem within the system itself, and that's where it's got to be fixed. And both sides of it. Yes, there's been some heinous things happen to Latinos, African Americans, Chinese, Japanese. I mean, the list goes on. The Second World War, my people were killed in Germany. But at the same time, we don't live in Germany. We live here. And here, you got to look at both sides of the coin here. There's a tremendous amount of people who do wrong, who do crimes, who kill people, who do trafficking in drugs and humans, etc. And they come across that border. And they happen to be Latino. What do? You got a profile somewhere. It's got to say that if, you know, three guys who were brown did this, you're not going to go pick on everybody else on the street. You're going to go after that particular look, feel, and style to see if you can filter down to catch whoever the bad guy is. So, in essence, there's a lot of those guys out there that are bad guys, and they can't just walk and get away with it because we've got to be sensitive. So, again, there's got to be something to do to fix this thing.
Right. And I don't have the answer to how to fix it. I'm just trying to point out the tendency and the history, because here's the real danger, Michael Ray. When you deny, and I'm glad you brought up the subject of Germany, because that's a perfect example to look at. We tend to take democracy as a given in this country because we've had it for 200 plus years and we've been taught that it will always be here. That's not necessarily so. And all you have to do is look at Weimar Germany to see how quickly democracy could disappear. And don't forget, the National Socialists, the Nazis, did not overthrow the government. They were elected. Hitler did not lead an overthrow of the government. He was appointed. All right. Now, the problem with infringing on the civil liberties of any particular group is that the danger that becomes the first step towards infringing on the civil liberties of all.
Yeah.
I ask everybody to remember Pastor Niemöller, who lived through Nazi Germany and was eventually put in a camp himself. And what he said was, first they came for the trade unionists, and I wasn't a trade unionist, so I didn't speak up. Then they came for the communists. I wasn't a communist, so I didn't speak up. Then they came for the Jews, and I wasn't a Jew, so I didn't speak up. Then they came for me, and there was nobody left to speak up.
Yeah.
So we need to remain vigilant and hold our leaders responsible and realize that it's up to us to keep democracy alive.
No, by the way, Jay, no question about it. We're starting to run out of time now. Is there a website we can find you and the book at?
Sure, www.jfeldman.com.
Wonderful. A.J. Feldman, and the book is Manufacturing Hysteria, A History of Scapegoating, Surveillance, and Secrecy in Modern America. Hey, Jay, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, the pleasure has been mine, and I appreciate your interest.
Take care. Good night.
Bye.
Some of these days you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only. 'Cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're gonna get. You know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Pam Oakes with us. Pamela Oakes, she's the author of Car Care for the Clueless, How You Can Make Money While Maintaining Your Vehicle. Hi, Pam. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Good evening, Michael. How are you?
Well, right now you're the person I want to talk to because I have a car, and the only thing I know how to do is put gas in it.
Yes.
This is scary.
About 99.9% of the populace out there, that's all they want to know. But, you know, that's the wrong approach because you've heard it with many other things, that knowledge is power. And people don't realize that your automobile is actually the most expensive thing that you'll ever purchase, even over a home, because it's not like you'll have one or two homes. You'll have multiple cars throughout your lifetime. So
see,
why not make money off of it?
Yeah, but I got excited about this. I know you're ASC certified. You've been a technician for 17 years, and you're the owner of the nationally recognized automotive center, PAMS Motor City Auto and Tire in Fort Myers, Florida. That's why when I saw this, I said, okay, what do I do now? My car is not a car. It's a computer. All I do is hit the button and I steer it. And when once a month I have OnStar, I get a maintenance thing. This thing from outer space tells me how many pounds of pressure is in my tires.
Of course, yes.
Yeah, that's scary
stuff.
And that's
because, I know. And it's things that, you know, you're not expected to know how it works. The whole premise behind the book is to understand the questions you need to ask your ASC automotive technician. So it keeps you on the road, keeps you on the right path.
Yeah, but I got to tell you, when it really comes down to it, which I think is hysterical, I'm old school. I was brought up, you know, with a stick shift, 6 or 8 cylinder motor, and you had spark plugs, and you put them in, and you put oil in it, and if anything happened, you ripped the transmission out. A bunch of guys came over, and you fixed it, and you took off. Not today.
Even when, you know, actually, I have one of those in my garage too. I still have my first car. It was my great grandfather's 69 Plymouth. And that's the nice thing is, like you said, it's old school. And, you know, that's that's where I first started learning automotive is I remember sitting on the fender and my great-grandfather teaching me how to set a choke.
I'll tell you what my first car was, but you got to promise not to tell anybody.
Okay.
Our secret. Okay?
Okay.
It was a 1950 Studebaker. It was blue and it had that bullet point front, and it was a little six, and it had a stick shift off the steering column.
Oh my gosh! What a rolling work of art! Isn't it a shame that they don't design them like that anymore?
Yeah, but it really was simple. It was so easy. I remember, Pam, I'll never forget. We're driving home from school. I got a bunch of the guys in the car. And we started seeing smoke coming up from underneath the dashboard, right? And there's smoke coming. So we pulled over to the side. Nobody knew what to do. We ran over to this guy's house, grabbed a garden hose, wet it down. We hosed the car off, and it turned out to be a little wire that the rubber had worn off of. And we put some tape on it, and we went home. That was it.
Don't you wish it was that easy today?
Yes, I would.
You know,
I'm glad you're here.
Even when things happen to us as professional automotive technicians, we may know what's going on, but we don't have the facilities or the tools to fix it on the roadside like days gone by.
Yeah.
And that's kind of sad, but, you know, people are demanding luxuries in their cars. They want the heated seats now. We've gotten spoiled. They want the backup camera. They want the GPS. And with this comes a price, and part of the price, everything's computerized. We have a different electrical and electronic system on the car now, and you know, keeps the novice out from underneath the hood.
No, absolutely, and I'll tell you what, it's scary. I get into my car, and I hit the button, and the seat starts to move forward, and it's positioned to where it was when I left the car. I've got all kinds of different air conditioning controls, and with my OnStar, if I'm not sure where I'm at, I hit the button and I say, I want to go to so-and-so, and they feed it in, and it talks me all the way into where I want to go. That today is a car, and I haven't had anything wrong with it, knock on wood. And who knows what's going to happen? How do you know what happens? What do you do when you take it in and you say, it's not working? How do you know if you got the right guy, the person that can do the job for you?
I'm going to teach you two words, how and why.
Okay. I'm going to the how.
Why do I have to have this repair? And I want you to ask him why as many times until you feel comfortable with the answer. And a professional ASE-certified automotive technician working at an ASE Blue Seal shop knows that this is part of his job, is to explain what's going on with the car. I do this at my shop all the time. I love it. I call it show and tell. And everybody will go out there and, oh, my God, I'll never know. And we just put it in layman's terms, and we explain why. And then the second word I always want you to remember is how. How is this going to benefit my vehicle? How is this going to keep my vehicle running? And, again, in layman's terms, if they start using 25-cent words with you, it's time to get a second opinion or a second shop. If they are condescending, same thing. Get a second opinion, get out of there. Because this is part of the technician's job now. Not only do they have to have the knowledge and skill to repair vehicles, they also have to be the go-between the car and the customer, the consumer.
Now, by the way, I think it's kind of interesting because, you know, geographically, people have certain problems that seem to happen over and over and over again, but you've got mm-hmm. your Car Care for the Clueless broadcast. You're a host every week on the radio, and I bet you hear some interesting things from people all over the place.
I sure do. And, it's even when they come into the shop, my shop, because I'm a working owner. I go out there and I turn wrenches and I talk to the customers and so on and so forth. And then I have the show. And it's, you know, just when you think you've heard everything, it's something else. And you're in awe. But it's mainly because people aren't asking these questions. They're not talking to their technician. They're not talking to the shop that they take their car to. And from not communicating, this is when they get into these bizarre pickles.
No, absolutely. Let me ask you a question, because I think this is something mm-hmm. on everybody's mind, too. The difference between all-wheel drive and four-wheel drive. You know, I'm in snow country, and there's a lot of people who are in snow country. Is there much of a difference between the two?
Well, the all-wheel drive is, like it says, all the time, 24/7. When you turn the key on, all four wheels are contributing to the forward or reverse movement of the vehicle. On a four-wheel drive, you have an option. You can have just the two or the four.
Hmm.
And now they've made it even so convenient. You're talking about how you like all these convenience. Before, they used to have to go out, and you used to actually have to engage the four-wheel drive on the front hubs of, you know, trucks and so on and so forth. And nowadays, you just press a button right from the cab of your vehicle.
Well, but in snow it's kind of either or now. It doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
So all wheel drive is just as good as four wheel drive in the snow.
Correct.
Oh, okay.
You just have to engage the four wheel drive.
Okay, but if you're all wheel drive, which is constant, you mm-hmm. just said, that's
right.
just as good as the four wheel drive in the snow then.
Yes. Yes, if you have six in one hand, half a dozen in the other.
Okay, so it's all same.
When you're in snow and you're in 4x4 mode, it's going to deliver the same as your all-wheel drive, basically.
Oh, okay. All right. Is there a preference for you? Which do you like better?
I used to be in snow country, and I no longer have that luxury of having to put boots on and chains on and all that.
you
don't
get to dress
at all
up
either.
Yeah,
but you know, depending upon what type of vehicle that I had, you know, if you have a truck, for an example, if you have a full size SUV, especially in the summer, you're not going to want that all wheel drive option. You're going to just have a two wheel drive.
Yeah,
you know. It depends. It depends upon the vehicle. It depends upon the driving conditions. There's a lot of variables to say yes or no. Personally, if I was in snow country again, I would definitely have a four-wheel drive SUV.
Yeah. Personally. Okay, all right, and that's snow country, and I got you loud and clear. There's something else that a lot of people have. There's that traction control.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is that something that's supposed to be on all the time, or you just use that when it's raining and wet?
I keep mine activated all the time. There's no reason why you should not have it activated unless you get yourself in a situation where, you want to, for an example, go drag racing at lights, then you would turn that off. But, which I don't think a lot of us do that anymore, except for my father. But that's another story. But, it's great because that traction control, even if you're in sunny weather and you pick up dirt or sand, you know, it's going to read each wheel how fast each wheel is going. And
you know, my favorite car 100 years ago, I had a 67 Plymouth Belvedere that if you drove up to it, it looked like anybody's little car. But if you look very close, you could see the engine kind of hanging from the bottom. It was sitting with a 440 underneath the hood. And let me tell you something, you punched that thing and it threw you through the back of the chair. But you can't do that anymore. Those don't work.
No, they don't. No, they don't at all. And, you know, the vehicles are designed for fuel economy, basically. The EPA has come in to all the manufacturers and they said, we need to have X amount of miles per gallon MPG per manufacturer. Per model year.
Yeah.
And little by little, even though we do have some of the performance cars still out there, on the average car like your 67 Belvedere, it's not on all the cars. And you know, it's a shame because it's a lost generation.
By the way, you bring up an interesting point. You said gas. There's obviously three kinds of gas when you go out. There's the, you know, the two forms of unleaded, and there's the premium. Does it really matter if you get the less expensive or go to the middle? Go to the middle gas, the little better unleaded, right before the premium. Does it really matter which you get?
Depending upon what kind of a car, but I can tell you what does matter. It does matter if you use a top tier fuel. Top tier fuel. There's a handful of petroleum companies that got together with a handful of vehicle manufacturers. They would be GM, VW, Audi, BMW, Mercedes, and the other one escapes me right at the second. I am so sorry. But they all got together and they said, we need a specific formula of fuel in the gasoline that you provide to give us optimum miles per gallon and performance in our vehicles. And there's a handful of them out there, and you can ask any Blue Seal shop. They'll give you a printout because the fuel, of course, is regional. For an example, we don't get Texaco down here while you may get Texaco up there, and that's one of the top-tier companies. So you get this list, and you put the top tier in your vehicle, and you always make sure, no matter what, you keep at least a quarter tank of gasoline in your car, you'll get your optimum miles per gallon out of that vehicle. Another good tidbit is you keep the proper air pressure. Air pressure, you can always find that in your driver's door jamb. Each car is different. If you stick by that, it'll give you optimum fuel economy, and your steering and braking capabilities will be what the designers were looking for when they made the car. You keep your air filter clean and you use your cruise control. I have to travel back and forth about 7 miles from work, and there are opportunities, even though the traffic's pretty heavy, but it's moving, I put my cruise control on, and we did a little experiment about 2 years ago where my fiance drove this one specific car for a week, and then I drove it for a week. Now, he's a little bit more of a conservative driver than me. I have a little bit more of a lead foot. But because I was using my cruise and I did everything that I was supposed to do, I actually had, in the same car using the same gasoline, a top-tier fuel, I was going 3 miles per gallon better than he was by playing by the rules.
Wow. Pam, we're just about running out of time. Website, we can find you and the book, and then how do we find you on the radio to listen?
Website is, I have two. I have carcareforthecluelist.com, all spelled out. And my shop website is pamsmotorcity.net. And you can hear my program each week on webtalkradio.net, Car Care for the Clueless.
Wonderful. Hey, Pam, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for asking.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Take care. Good night.
Promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, that told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charm.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
My own, I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone.
Ellen Lubin Sherman with us. She's the author of The Essentials of Fabulous, because whatever doesn't work here anymore. As a matter of fact, she's got her start in business feeding gossip items to Liz Smith, the esteemed gossip columnist. In those early days of name droppers were the perfect foundation for her later work in cultivating and branding identities for some of the country's most luxurious products. And she's worked for some of New York's top communications firms, advising top peer brands, including The Gap, Perrier Water, and Martha Stewart. And for more than 30 years now, she has flexed her fabulous muscles, guiding leaders and luxury brands to infuse their identities with flair. And let us say, Ellen, I welcome to the show. I am so glad you're with us.
Oh, okay.
Okay, well, all right. So, no, we got you on, and we've done the intro, and we're waiting to get fabulous.
Well, the book is really a primer on so many things that I think make people outstanding. And I had gotten to the point of being anguished over the seemingly impervious and rude behavior that we're all forced to endure on a daily basis. And so I cobbled together a lot of ideas and reached out to a professional editor, because I'm quite disorganized and can't seem to write an outline. And she was the one that identified the fact that I seemed to be obsessed with the word fabulous and that I should write the book about how to be fabulous. And trust me, I'm not fabulous, but I sure know it when I see it.
Now, by the way, what is fabulous? How can you not be fabulous and write about fabulous. And how can you not be fabulous to recognize it out there? So you got to have it within you, Ellen, before you can recognize it outside of yourself.
Well, I looked up narcissism yesterday in the DSM Roman numeral for the psychiatric manual, just to make sure that I'm not narcissistic. I'm a fabulous in training, as I say. Fabulous people are not necessarily the leaders of a company or running a national office. They are the people that, when you meet them, they have this great sense of energy about themselves and great sense of optimism about the day. And they make you feel good about yourself. There's so many opportunities that we have to give someone our undivided attention, and yet we don't do it. So while I'm not fabulous in every sense of the word, I think that I really live what I believe in, which is that everyone deserves our respect and everybody deserves our time, and we have to slow down, and stop using "I'm so busy" as an excuse for "I'm being really rude now."
You know what I think fabulous is taking the time, along the lines you're talking about, taking the time to pay attention to someone. I remember it was about, I've told the story on the air before a couple of times, but I think it's apropos now. Radio Susie and I were doing some business downtown in the Milwaukee area. And I remember we parked in the parking lot and we walked up to the door of the building, and I opened the door and Susie walked through the door, and there was a young woman on the other side of the door. Could have been more than 35, 38, somewhere along there. And I stood there and I held the door open as she came through, and she stopped and she looked at the both of us, and Ellen, she almost had tears in her eyes. She said, "You know, nobody does that anymore. They don't pay attention." And she said, "Thank you." And I said, "You're welcome." And, you know, she walked away. And it's true. We don't do those things anymore. And sometimes if you do, you get shot down for it. So it's very touchy. And I have of the opinion that even if you're going to get shot down, go ahead and do it. Open doors, pick something up, help somebody get something off the shelf. And in and of itself, that is a piece of being fabulous.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's really when Sidney Pollack did a film about Frank Gehry, I mentioned that in the book, he went and interviewed all the people that he had done wonderful architectural forms for, whether it was Barry Diller and his IAC building, or the building that he's done all at the Walt Disney Concert Hall. And the one thing that everybody said about Frank Gehry, they didn't talk about his talent, which is undeniable. They didn't talk about his visionary skills, which is undeniable. They all said he was fun. He was fun to work with. He was upbeat. He was chipper. He was optimistic. He had a great sense of humor. And sometimes that gets lost in the fray of, we have to get this done. Seriousness, the top-down management. Everybody has to work really hard, and nobody has to laugh. Well, you know what? They did a study, and they found out that in an office where there's some level of levity, people worked harder and longer than in offices where it was just grind. So, you know, in addition to the great manners, we also have to stop and think, how can I imbue this experience with a little bit of levity to make the day go faster, to enjoy the day? And I think that's another thing we've lost sight of. It's just we're just caught up in ourselves. We're absolutely caught up in ourselves, and we're just not thinking about how we impact the people around us.
You know, by the way, when you talk about the businesses where there's some levity, there's some lightness within the business, what occurs there is you start to smile, that old adage that laughter is the best medicine. You start to smile and your brain releases endorphins and you start to feel good about what you're doing. And sometimes you get a shot of dopamine, which comes from that feel good part of your brain. That's the very thing that causes addiction and so on and so forth. And feeling good about yourself and feeling good about somebody else can also be very addictive. So what you're talking about truly is a chemical reaction.
Oh, absolutely. It's they've known this as emotional contagion. You're really only as happy as the person who's sitting about a foot away from you. But I look at it from a, almost like an industrial engineering kind of experience or industrial psychology. I know that the people who are negative cause systemic damage to any company, whether it's a radio show, whether it's a Fortune 100 company. Negative people drag you down. That's why I talk about why fabulous people are so good to be around, because they always see the joke in everything. And I don't mean that they make fun of things that are not funny. But
sure.
Shortly before I came on your show, this is kind of like my bedtime, I put on a pair of high-heeled shoes with a polka dot sock. And here I'm in my pajamas, and I'm wearing these shoes. Why am I wearing these shoes? Because when you wear your shoes, you sit up a little straighter.
Yeah.
I'm taking this seriously. I'm here to entertain and educate your listeners. But I have to make myself get into the mood of it. I have to get myself into the groove of it. And too many people walk around without any sense of grooming or any sense of discipline, and then they expect to get promoted. It's not going to happen, not in this economy.
No, not at all. And I'm glad you got dressed for the show.
Thank you. Only my shoes.
You're welcome. I got it. That's okay. It was something. It was you put the extra effort into it. I love every second of it.
I'm having fun with you.
Thank you. And I believe really when it comes down to it that you do have to feel that way. It's if you're not going to put yourself out for something, don't do it. And I really believe that's where the fabulous, I think, is a state of mind. It's not how you look. It's how you experience yourself and how you experience life. And everything in and of itself, no matter what it is, Ellen, it's a state of mind. It's your attitude and how you look at something and how you respond and how you react. And when you get to the point in life and you realize that you're responsible for everything that goes on in your life and the consequence is that the outcomes are based on how you handle it, how you do it. I can't stop you from walking up and slapping me in the face, but I can be responsible for how I feel about it. And that's really where it lies. And if we got more and more of that responsibility inside of us, life would be a lot different with a lot different people, and a lot of the problems that we face wouldn't be there.
I totally agree. And it's so funny that you talked about the word attitude, because most employers will choose someone with less aptitude but with a superior attitude.
Yes.
People with great attitudes are just terrific, because they absolutely will do whatever it takes to master the skill. They bring in that energy, that fresh, bracing air about themselves and about their work. A company filled with people with a superb attitude extend their brand. They let everybody around them. I think they're talking about that tonight with Steve Jobs, that he infused Apple with this sense of passion for what they did. Perfectionist, yes, but also passionate that every product had to be first rate. And that's why the company grew, and that's why the company is probably the number one company in the world today. So when you look at passion, it's not just something little. And people shouldn't look at this book and say, oh my God, I'll never get to do it. You don't do it in one day. You don't accomplish all these things in one day. But you make steps. You make small little steps so that you correct some awful habits that we've all taken for granted. For example, yesterday I dismissed call waiting. I realized that call waiting was the same thing as going to a dinner party and looking over your shoulder for somebody more important.
Yeah.
I said to myself, why am I doing this? Let the messages take it. And I canceled the call waiting. And you wouldn't believe the number of people that wrote in on my blog. Oh, my God, you've made me rethink the whole thing. I'm getting rid of call waiting. Call waiting in the 1980s was the beginning of this country's trajectory towards a more rude and impervious community.
You know, there's a word called mindful, and I'm not a meditator or anything, but there's a word called mindful, and so many people talk about it. Mindful is becoming aware of where you are at the time. There's so many of us who go through life, and you don't even know where you're at. You're in a hurry to go absolutely nowhere, and nothing exists. I'll give you a prime example of that. Are you sitting at a desk by chance?
You're talking about flow.
No, yeah, but are you sitting at a desk?
Right.
Well, are you? Are you by
but
a
are
desk?
Are you talking about like a flow of creativity? Is that what you're talking about?
No, no. Just bear with me. Bear with me. Are you where you are right now? Is there a desk there? Or is there a chair there? What's the surroundings? Is there a desk? Is there a chair? What's around you when we're talking here?
Well, people are not interacting nearly as much. Everything is very virtual.
Oh, no,
and
no, bear
our virtual presence can be very negative. Too many rough emails, poorly written, grammatically incorrect, text message, you know, from the side of the road. You can barely understand what they're saying. All this has driven us into a state of isolation.
Yeah.
I remember going to see my son at college, and he was text messaging somebody that was in the same coffee shop that he was sitting in. And I said, wait a second, who are you writing to? Oh, the guy crossed at the other table. Well, why don't you get up and talk to him? No, this is easier this way. So you've got a situation where these young people are coming out of college without any social skills. How can they possibly interview for a job? How can they possibly engage in a conversation? How can they even get married? They have no social adeptness. And this is all part of what it is to be fabulous. Fabulous people are visible even when they're virtual. You know what you're going to get. You see my name in the inbox. You're probably prepared for something quite amusing. I have branded my emails to be a reflection of how I see the world. Everybody can do that. That is not a big deal.
Now, by the way, we're just about out of time, but you will indelibly be branded in my mind in this particular way. You ready?
Yes.
Pajamas and high heels. I'll never forget it.
Okay.
Hey, loud and clear. Alan, do you have a website we can find you at?
Well, I'm on www.essentialsoffabulous.com. The book is available at Amazon, iTunes, iPod, Kindle, Nook, however you want to do it. Whatever gizmo gets you crazy, you can go do it. I think it's an easy read. I think it's a beautiful book. It's beautifully illustrated. And I think it's uplifting. I think people get a big charge out of it because it's a positive book. It focuses on your positives, not just positives, but your positives. And we've got to focus on our positives more.
We're running out of time. I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much. I had a pleasure being with you.
Great. Okay, good night.
But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't anymore. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
They'll linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.
Do.